Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on education when we come back. Well, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights of great and the small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures of great and the small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution, at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. They said, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. Now, in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents have introduced our current practice of the first, the second, and the fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they've given us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today, we are the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in our business school conducted twice a year here at the law school. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you start with our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct at 417-273-4967. Well, if we were to take a look at education here in America and say that the system is broke, I don't think we'd be too far from accurate, and I don't think we'd be making an oversimplification. Many people have written books, papers, periodicals, denouncing the system. The real bottom line is, what caused it to get this way? I went to public school back in the 1940s and 50s, and it wasn't anywhere near as poor as it is today. Everybody who graduated from high school in 1957 in our graduating class could read their own diplomas. There wasn't a single illiterate in that class. And if there was, he was so well concealed we couldn't find him. Today, 2 million Americans a year are added to the list, that is, the numbers of illiterates in the United States. Can you believe that? 2 million a year added to the list. Now, of course, a lot of those people come into the country and they're illiterate when they walk across the Rio Grande River. But then that's not to say that the public schools don't turn out their share of illiterates. And a fellow by the name of David Barton, who wrote a book called America to Pray or Not to Pray, back about 1988, I think it was. Let me take a look here and see when he... Yeah, 1988, 1991, David Barton, from Wall Builder Press, Aledo, Texas. He wrote a neat little book here. It's about 150 pages. Let me flip back here and I'll tell you, yeah, about 160 pages. And in Chapter 4, he made some rather remarkable statements and from information that he got from our Department of Education. And, of course, his thing in life is that morals have been divorced from the public school system under a number of cases from the Supreme Court, which have banished the Ten Commandments, God, and prayer from our public schools. So in case you didn't know this, there was a time in America when we prayed in public school, when we had the Ten Commandments, and we weren't afraid to mention God in public school. Now, it's not done today because somebody woke up and said, oh my God, our forefathers, you know, the people that wrote the Constitution, and everybody from then until the enlightened ones took over the Supreme Court back in the late 1940s, 50s, and 60s, had made a terrible mistake by allowing that kind of conduct to be going on in our public schools. But I want to point out that we weren't having the kind of problems that we're having today in our public schools, you know, just 50 years ago. Let me give you a little illustration here. Do you know what the number one problem was in 1947 in public school? The number one problem was talking in class. In the year 2007, do you know what the number one problem is in the public school systems of America? It's rape. That's your number one problem in public school, rape. In 1947, the number two problem was chewing gum in school. Do you know what the number two problem is in 2007? It's robbery. Robbery. Rape and robbery. Top two problems. 1947, top two problems, talking and chewing gum. Number three, 1947, making noise in class. Number three today is assault. 1947, the number four problem was running in the halls. Today, the number four problem in public school systems nationwide is burglary. Number five, 1947, the fifth biggest problem that school teachers had was children getting out of turn in line. Today, it's arson, number five. Number six, 1947, wearing improper clothing was the number six problem. Today, the number six problem is bombings in the public school. Number seven, not putting your paper in the waste paper baskets in 1947 was the number seven big problem. Today, the seventh problem in public school is murder. M-U-R-D-E-R. Rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, and murder. Top seven problems today. Talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothing, not putting paper in the waste paper baskets were the top seven problems back in 1947. Something has changed, wouldn't you say? Something is radically different today from what it was back in 1947. And Barton starts off by saying, since 1962, the courts have delivered ruling after ruling eradicating all vestiges of religious principles from education. Notice the features once thought essential to education, which are now excluded. First, prayer. Prayer in its public school system breaches the constitutional wall of separation between church and state. Engel versus Vitale, 1962. The practice of having invocations delivered prior to public high school games had the primary effect of advancing religion and thus violated the First Amendment, says the Supreme Court in Jagger versus Douglas, 1989. As it relates to the Bible, the courts have said, if portions of the New Testament were read to the students, they could be, and had been, psychologically harmful to the child. Abingdon versus Shemp, 1963. That's right. Our Supreme Court says that reading the New Testament to school children is psychologically harmful to the child. And in Roberts versus Madigan in 1989, that same court said school district acted properly in prohibiting teacher from silently reading the Bible to himself in the school classroom during silent reading period. So if you're a teacher in the public school and you're having a reading period, and you have a Bible in that classroom and you read it silently to yourself, it breaks the law. Isn't that just real special? Ten Commandments. The mere posting, the court says, of the copies of the Ten Commandments, the First Amendment prohibits, if the posted copies of the Ten Commandments are to have any effect at all, it will be to induce the school children to read, meditate upon, perhaps to venerate, and even obey the commandments. This is not permissible. Stone versus Graham, 1980. And then, spiritual heritage. The bill's sponsor intended to provide children the opportunity of sharing in their spiritual heritage of Alabama and this country, and this violates the First Amendment. So says Wallace versus Jaffrey in 1984. The acknowledgement of God is also a violation of the law, so says our courts. To include reference to God would violate the First Amendment in Ohio versus Wisner, 1976. So the removal of religious principles created a value-free environment, one free of moral absolutes or fixed rights and wrongs. The removal of moral absolutes based on religious principles has altered every aspect of student life, morality, behavior, and achievement. Numerous statistical measurements are available which indicate those changes. And although for many categories there are statistical measurements which span decades, student achievement scores, for instance, dropout rates, high school equivalency testing, and so on, many of the current areas of concern have very few tangibles for comparing the present with the past. And understandably so. For when the American education system was sound and commanded international respect, few statistics were kept in non-problem areas. For example, measurements on school violence and school crime rarely appeared prior to the mid-1970s. Since school violence had not been a problem, very few records on school violence were kept. Today, that is not the case. Numerous other categories which provide very little data from the past, such as illiteracy, teacher competency, etc., testify that these were recent problems. Problems intensified since the court ordered religious principles out of education. First, the SAT test. One of the premier indicators of student achievement is the SAT, or the Scholastic Aptitude Test. The SAT, a test measuring a student's verbal and math skills, was first administered to high school students in 1926. In 1941, a common scale was established to allow annual comparisons of the scores. Consequently, the SAT is a very valuable resource because it remains the only major achievement test that has not been recently renormed. It has been comparing apples with apples since 1941. Now, the following graphs designate the point at which religious principles were first separated from education, and the consequences are very evident. The court-ordered removal of religious principles from education initiated 18 consecutive years of decline, which is unprecedented in the history of the SAT score. Prior to 1962-63, the SAT scores had not declined more than two consecutive years in a row. Although uninterrupted declines occurred following the separation of religious principles, the rate of decline had slowed by the mid-70s, and from 1981, scores actually improved until 1987, when they again turned downward. Now, if the removal of religious principles caused the downturn, why would the decline slow in 1974 and 75? And then, why would the scores turn upward in 1981? After all, religious principles had not been returned to education, at least not in the public schools. Well, in 1974-75, when the rate of decline first began to slow, a new trend had emerged in education. Large numbers of private religious schools began to appear. And according to the Department of Education figures, between 74 and 84, private school enrollment jumped 17%, reaching an enrollment of 8.5 million students by 1984. The dramatic increase of private school students is even more remarkable when realizing that the total number of students attending school in the nation actually decreased between 1974 and 1984. Now, the fantastic growth in private school enrollment was primarily seen among religiously affiliated schools. That's according to the College Board. And they said that 72% of private school students attend religiously affiliated schools. And as an example, accredited Christian education had 479 affiliate schools in 1974, but by 1984, 10 years later, the number had jumped to over 6,000 schools with more than 240,000 students. Now, the American Association of Christian Schools represented 125 schools and 16,000 students in 1972, but by 1990, that number had climbed to 1,200 schools with 165,000 students. And in the Association of Christian Schools International, the number of students in its affiliated schools increased from 186,000 in 78 to 475,000 in 1989. The significant growth rate in Christian schools was commented upon by several national observers. For instance, a December 20th, 1984 USA Today article reported that enrollments at denominational schools had increased a remarkable 22% in the three-year period from 1981 to 1984. The February 3rd, 1985 Washington Post presented a chart depicting the Christian school explosion. Christian schools in the United States in 1965 totaled 1,000. In 1985, they totaled 13,000. And although 13,000 Christian schools had been projected by the conclusion of the 1985 school year, that projection turned out to be low. Paul A. Krennel, president of the ACSI, reports that a curriculum publisher conducted a search in the Library of Congress and could account for more than 32,000 Christian schools. The increase in enrollment among Christian schools continued until 1987, at which time it began a slight decrease. So let's notice this correlation. When the number of students in private religious schools began increasing, the scores began to improve from their dramatic slide. When the number of students attending private religious schools began to decline, so did the scores. And while this correlation is of interest, students in private religious schools could have caused a positive impact on scores only if they achieve higher SAT scores than their counterparts in public school. In 1987, the College Board began to separate the SAT scores in a manner which allows comparison of scores between students from private religious schools and their peers in public schools. The results are shown on the graph below. Since public school scores are lower than the national totals, it is evident that there, were it not for the positive effect of the private religious schools raising those scores, the SAT scores would be even lower than they currently are. The disparity between public and non-public scores since 1987 is great enough to suggest that the same differences probably existed prior to 1987. And furthermore, in the years of decreasing private religious school enrollment, the years when the SAT again returned downward, the private religious school scores were improving. For the national scores to be declining when private religious school scores are improving shows that there simply are no longer enough private school students to pull the national average upwards against the much greater pressure of the public school students who are pulling the schools downward. A further indicator of superior Christian school achievement is provided through the Stanford Achievement Test. It's an achievement test used in both public and private schools nationally. The Association of Christian Schools International comprised 2,700 affiliate schools and 475,000 students, and it utilizes this test. Notice the difference between Christian school and public school scores on the same test. Another academic test which shows comparable disparities in favor of private religious school students is the PSAT-NMSQT Preliminary Scholastic Aptitude Test, the National Merit Scholarship Qualifying Test. High scores on this test can qualify a student to receive National Merit Scholarships. Those who qualify as semifinalists for the scholarships are considered the academic cream of the crop, the top one-half percentile of their state's graduating class. In the 1988 results, only 15,414 students qualified as semifinalists from the initial field of 1,213,000. Following the release of the 1988 results, a survey was undertaken to determine which schools were the source of these academically superior students. And according to the Department of Education, at the time of the testing, 87.6% of the students attended public schools and 12% attended private religious schools. So with the public schools having 87% of the students, they would be expected to produce 87% of the semifinalists. 12% of the semifinalists would be expected to be coming from the private religious schools, but surprisingly, the survey revealed that 40% of the stellar academic performers came from the private schools. Not 12%, 40%. That's a percentage three times greater than their proportional size. The detailed results of that survey are provided in Appendix C. And the following graph indicates the disproportionately positive impact of the private schools on education. With private schools proportionally supplying 1.6 times more SAT takers than their relative percentage, 20% as opposed to 12%, supplying 3.2 times more than their relative percentage of academically elite students, 40% as opposed to 12%, producing students with higher achievement scores than their public school counterparts at every grade level. Private schools are having a positive academic effect dramatically greater than their relative size. Now, some have tried to dismiss the stark difference in academic achievements between private and public schools by arguing that affluency is the major reason that private schools surpass public schools in academic achievements. However, when the money expended per student in private schools, which is an indicator of affluency, is compared with public schools, it is apparent that money is not a significant factor in private school achievement. I'm going to pause right here and give you a couple of numbers here, boys and girls. Write this down. How much does it cost to educate a child in homeschool? Answer, $546 a year. So write it down. Private home school, $546 a year. What does it cost on average to educate a child in a parochial school? Answer, $2,300 a year, or approximately four times more. How much does it cost to educate a child in an average public school? The answer is $7,000 per year, per student. So it costs about $600 a year to educate your kid at home, $2,400 a year, four times more to educate him down at the local Baptist school, and 12 times more to educate him in the local public school. And the academic, the real on-the-ground net bottom-line results. In the home schools, the children score on average at the 87th percentile, in the parochial schools at the 80th percentile, and in the public schools on average at the 50th percentile. So you spend roughly twice as much money. It's actually more than twice as much, nearly three times as much, to educate a child in public school as you do in a parochial school, and he gets 60% poorer in his scores. What do you make of that, kids? Now, you could sit there and say, well, it doesn't have anything to do with the Ten Commandments, morality, or prayer in the public school. Well, okay. But before you got rid of prayer, God, and the Ten Commandments from your public schools, your children were smarter and did better. When we taught morality in our public schools, we got higher test scores. So why is it today that we don't? And while you're mulling that over, private schools are spending only half the money per student as public schools, and yet they have higher achievement. And additionally, in 1984, the median income of those sending their children to private schools was $26,500. That was only slightly higher than the national median. However, the slightly higher income of private school families actually doesn't exist, since private school families pay for their children's education twice. They pay public school taxes once to educate their children in public schools, and then they turn around and they pay the private school's tuition fees on top of that. So when the average tuition cost of only one student, the average family includes two children, is deducted from the average income of private school families, public school families actually have more unrestricted money available for their children than do those who send their children to private school. How do you like that, children? Then, in the consideration of enhanced private religious school achievements, an observation should be made. The primary difference between private religious schools and public schools is not in the core curriculum. The Civil War occurs the same years at both types of schools. Math tables remain the same. They don't change from school to school. And a verb does not become an adjective merely because a student attends a religious school. And since the core academic curriculum, the basis for educational testing, is fundamentally the same for both types of school, there is reason to believe that the measurable differences in academic achievement may be attributed to the educational philosophy under which the curriculum is being applied. In 72% of private schools, religious principles hold a predominant or prominent position in the school's educational philosophy and instructional process. Now, even though students' achievement test scores have fallen dramatically since 1962 and 63, their report card scores have actually risen. The top graph reflects students' report card grades collected and released by the American College Testing Program, the producers of the ACT test. By examining only report card scores in the top graph, one could easily conclude that students were showing academic improvement. After all, their report card scores are rising year after year. However, the bottom chart reveals that student achievement, as measured on the ACT test, a college-bound test similar to the SAT, has been declining during the same time. Students have actually been receiving higher grades in school for knowing less. Now, that's a clear contradiction of educational standards, don't you think? And while you're mulling that one over, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and ordering it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Remember, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about education, and we're reviewing a book called America to Pray or Not to Pray by David Barton. You can get a copy by calling 817-441-6044. Again, that's 817-441-6044. Now, this is put out by Wall Builder Press. Wall Builder Press, P.O. Box 397, Aledo, Texas, 76008. P.O. Box 397, Aledo, A-L-E-D-O, Texas, 76008. David Barton. Teacher Competency Testing. With the growing awareness of poor student performance, attention has begun to focus not only on the educational system in general, but on teachers in particular. Features such as the Dallas Times-Herald special report can be found in most major newspapers across the country from time to time. Notice these highlights in this report. 20 states have acted to stem the flow of teachers who cannot spell, cannot add, or cannot punctuate by requiring competency testing for teachers. That's 20 states now are requiring competency testing for teachers who cannot spell, add, or punctuate a paragraph. So when the test was given last April to 1,269 juniors in the Texas teacher education programs, 38% failed the exam, which tests basic skills taught by the 12th grade, such as calculating percentages, capitalizing words, and comprehending a 200-word passage. Now let me pause here, put my famous mark in the margin, and let's think about this for a second. Here's the state of Texas. And they want to hire a bunch of teachers. So they take 1,269 juniors in Texas teacher education programs. So these are 1,269 students in their third year of college in teaching school looking for a teaching credential. Now we're talking about 1,300 people here, round numbers. 38% of them can't pass the test. No. We're not talking about rocket science. We're talking about they can't work percentages. A very simple, very basic thing that you learned back in the third and fourth grade. Can you remember Mrs. Wiles teaching you how to do percentages in the fourth grade? I can. How about punctuating a paragraph? You know, you got a paragraph, and you read the paragraph, and you got to put in the periods, commas, colons, semicolons, exclamation points, question marks. 38% of these juniors in college couldn't do what we had to learn how to do in the fourth and fifth grades, kids. And these are the people who, after they graduate from college, they come out with their teaching credentials. First of all, they went to college and they got a BS degree, which is exactly apropos. It's a BS degree. Then they go to teacher school over here to get a teaching certificate over here, and 38% of them plunk out. Not because it's advanced math or calculus that they had to go to Cambridge to learn how to do, but because they can't do simple percentages or punctuate a paragraph. How do you like that? Now, if you're sitting there as a truck driver or a housewife saying, well, I can't punctuate a paragraph either, well, then you're the victim of the public school system. You couldn't have graduated from Catholic school without being able to do percentages and punctuating a sentence. Now, if you've got a high school diploma, if you've got a piece of paper that says, I've successfully completed high school, it means less than nothing to those of us who are employers. And I can tell you that from personal experience. When somebody tells me that he's a high school graduate, I look at him and I say, is that really so? Really? Oh, yeah? A little later on, Barton points out that many big corporations like AT&T, IBM, General Electric, when they're hiring people to work on their assembly lines and to do just basic work, not college level, not management, not executive vice president, just working out there on the floor, have to put those employees through a remedial program to teach them how to read, teach them how to understand or recognize and comprehend instructions, and to do basic arithmetic. And then you're paying $500 billion a year for this public education system that turns out thousands of students a year that can't read their own diplomas. And what's worse, you're turning out the teachers who are going to teach the next generation. Now, the test was also given to 3,300 new teachers in the Houston Independent School District. Because of cheating, let me underline that, because of cheating on the part of these candidates, now these are your teachers. These are the teachers that are going to be teaching your children in school. Because of cheating and other irregularities, scores for only 2,400 of the teachers were reported. Now, almost two-thirds, that 62%, failed the exam. God, my God. You bring in 3,300 new teachers, and let's see, 900 of them have to be excluded for cheating, and then two-thirds of the 2,400, 62% of 2,400, let me do my percentages here, 2,400 times 0.62 is 1,488 of them flunked the test. 1,500 of them out of 24 failed it. What would you think if your plumber came out to fix your pipes and you said, let me give you a simple plumbing test, and your plumber failed the test? He doesn't know what kind of glue to glue the pipes together. He doesn't know what size threader to thread the pipe with. He doesn't know what kind of compound to put on the threads. I mean, come on, kids. Out in the real world, you know, you're either a plumber or you're not. You know, you either know how to cut the board or you don't. Now, these are people, of course, that have degrees from college. And they're going out to take a test so that they can qualify to work as your teacher in your public school. Now, what they do when these teachers fail, do you know what they do? then they substitute a new test with lower standards so that they can pass it. That's why your kids are getting A's and B's, and they're getting dumber and dumber, getting higher scores on their report cards. What we're doing is we're reducing the requirements of the test. Now, remember last night I showed you an 1895 test in the 8th grade. Now, my granny, she only went to the 8th grade. That was my old granny. My granddad only went to the 6th grade. And in this test, which came out of Kansas in 1895, in the 8th grade final exam in Salinas, Kansas, the students had to be able to give, and this is a 60-minute test, and there's 10 parts to the test in 60 minutes. So that's 6 minutes for each part. You got to give 9 rules for the use of capital letters. You got to name the parts of speech and define those that have no modifications. Define verse, stanza, and paragraph. What are the principal parts of a verb? Give the principal parts of lie, play, and run. Number 5, define case. Illustrate each case. What is punctuation? Give rules for principal marks of punctuation. And 7 through 10, write a composition of about 150 words and show therein that you understand the practical use of the rules of grammar. How these students down here taking the test to become the teachers in your public school in Houston, Texas, couldn't even read the damn thing, much less punctuate it. And then you wonder why Johnny can't read? Hell, the teacher can't read! For crying out loud. And yet they still hire him because there isn't anybody else. There isn't anybody else to fulfill or to fill the position. Dallas school officials, and this is Dallas school officials, say that on the same test, 1,223 of the 2,280 teachers hired by the Dallas school district since 1979, 54% of them could not answer correctly 67% of the questions. Let me put that in a little plainer English. Let's suppose there's 10 of us. Half of us couldn't answer two-thirds of the questions. Half of the students, just take the class, divide it in half. Half of them could not answer 2 questions out of 3. And you're going to hire a jerk like that and put him in your school and educate your kid? I tell you, if you're a truck driver with a third grade education, you couldn't do worse than that. In fact, most homeschoolers do not have college degrees and have not been trained in college, and they do not have a teaching credential. That's more than half. Did you know that? And those students score at the 87th percentile nationally on average. In the public schools, they score at 50. I'm surprised that they score at 50. I'm surprised with this kind of BS. Almost two-thirds, 62%, failed the exam. The Houston School Board later lowered the passing score so that only 44% of the teachers failed. You got 62%. Got 100 people in here. 62 of them take the test and flunk. So you lower the standards in the test so that only 44 of them flunk. What kind of stupidity are we dealing with here? Well, as we progress along, we're going to find out there's nothing stupid about this. This is not stupid at all. This is a part and parcel with what I reported to you in the last program of Hegelian dialectics. Comes right out of the Prussian schools. In 1819, remember this story now, in 1819 in Prussia, the first compulsory schooling for children was instituted. According to educator John Taylor Gatto, the society in Prussia was divided into children who will become policymakers, children who will become assistants to policymakers, that is, the engineers, architects, lawyers, and doctors, and then the children who will be the vast, massed, used. So Prussia set up a 3-tier school system in which 0.5% of the population is taught to think. Those are the children of Ted Kennedy and George Bush who go to private schools. And then one half of 1% of the population is taught to think. They go to school called academia. 5.5% of the population go to the real schooling, where they partially learn to think, but not completely, because Prussia believed their defeat at the hands of Napoleon was caused by people thinking for themselves at times of stress on the battlefield. They were going to see to it that scientifically this couldn't happen. So then the balance, the lowest 94%, went to the Volksschulen, where they were to learn harmony, obedience, freedom from stressful thinking, and how to follow instructions. Now, sir, this isn't stupid. This isn't being done accidentally. This is being done on purpose. It's programmed that way. It's designed that way for your children. Your children are not designed to think. And like as not, you aren't either. You know, if your brain worked and you could think for yourself, the world would be a much different place than it is today. I mean, just you personally. For you, the world would be a different place. Now, in an effort to weed out the most incompetent teachers, 26 states have adopted teacher competency testing programs, although only 22 currently publish their results. While many observers believe that the teacher incompetency problem is not severe, what's happening in teacher testing prepared by the Department of Education presents an entirely different picture. In those states publicizing their competency testing results, 17% of the applicants failed. 17%. One time, I had a fella come in here. He was a druggist, and he wanted to move from New Jersey to Missouri. And he was kind of concerned because he said, "Well, I'll have to take my test over again to qualify as a pharmacist." And I looked at the guy and I said, "So what difference does that make?" And he said, "Well, you know, it's been a long time since I took this test." I said, "Excuse me. Are you a pharmacist in New Jersey?" He said, "Yes." "Are you licensed, bonded, and insured?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Did you pass a test there?" "Yes." "Did you go to college?" "Yes." "Do you know your drugs?" "Yes." "What the hell difference does it make where you take the test?" And he thought about it for a minute and he said, "Well, yeah, you know, come think of it, you're probably right." You know, kids, wake up. Pay attention here. You know, when you take a test, what we're after is, do you know the answer to this question? It doesn't make any difference whether you were educated in the public school, parochial school, or you just went to the local library and picked up a book and read the information. You either know it or you don't. Now, I'm a plumber, by trade, and I go out and I put pipes together. And I either know how to measure those pipes and fit those pipes and put them together, or I don't. It doesn't make any difference whether I take a plumbing test in California or New York or Zimbabwe, for crying out loud. You either know how to use a tape measure and measure the pipe and cut it off at the right length and put an elbow in, or you don't. If you don't, you need to be taught. If you do, you can pass that test any place. 12 inches on a ruler is the same in California as it is in New York. 12 inches is 12 inches. A 1-inch pipe is a 1-inch pipe. It carries the same volume of water in California as it does in Florida. Now, you might not know how much water a 1-inch pipe carries, in which case you might flunk the test. You're supposed to know things like that. Now, since the Bible teaches that a student will become like his teacher, as we see in Luke 6, verse 40, it is appropriate to be concerned about the teacher competency. Nearly 41 million students are enrolled in public schools in 1990, and if 17% of the students were taught by incompetent teachers, that translates into 7 million adversely affected students. The biblical admonition that the student will become like his teacher is very sobering. Can we afford 7 million students to become like these 17% of the incompetent teachers? Now, according to statistics made available during a White House briefing attended by the author in September of 1989, 700,000 students graduated from high school in June of 1986 who were unable to read their own diplomas after completing 12 years of formal education. Let me repeat that. David Barton is in Washington, D.C. at a White House briefing attended by this author in September of 1989, before he wrote this book, or right after, I guess he wrote this book. And he reports that 700,000 students who graduated in June of 1986 couldn't read their own diplomas. How in the hell can you graduate from high school and be illiterate? How can that be? Well, it's designed that way. You see, the 94% of the students who go to public school are designed to be dumbed down. You're not supposed to think for yourself. You're not supposed to be educated. We're going to call you educated. We're going to call the process education. But that's not what it actually is. You know, it's time to wake up and grow up. You know, if you want your child to come out as an incompetent, a person who can't think, can't read, can't write, and who is academically a dullard, public school is the place to send them. You can't get a better place than that. Now, if on the other hand, you're like a couple, 3 million other people that say, geez, I'd like my kid to be able to walk, talk, and chew gum, maybe do it all at the same time. Gerald Ford couldn't, but maybe my kid could learn how. Then maybe you want to send him to the local Catholic school. I don't want you to write me an email now and say, well, what's the matter with you, Gordon? You turned into a Catholic? No. It's just that you can't turn a kid out of a Catholic school that can't read his diploma. They don't allow it. So, while I don't agree with Catholic religious philosophy, if they could just teach your kid how to read, for crying out loud, it'd be a step in the right direction, wouldn't it? Now, if you want to go a step further than that, why don't you take your kid out of the public school, forget the private school, educate your kid at home. It'll cost you $550 a year. $550 a year per kid. That's one-tenth of what it costs to educate a child in... it's less than that. $7,500 to be, you know, it's less than 10%. 10% would be $700. Cost $7,000 to educate a kid in public school. There's public schools out there that cost $14,000 per child per year. Did you know that? $14,000 a year to educate a kid in public school. He comes out and he can't read his diploma. And you want to pay that kind of money? Hell, why don't you put the $14,000 a year in your back pocket? Take the old lady on a trip to Europe, for crying out loud. The kid doesn't need to go to school. If when he gets out of the 12th grade, he can't read his diploma, and you paid how much? Let's test this. Here's $14,000 a year times how many years? 12 years? That's $168,000. You don't need to spend $168,000 to teach a kid to be illiterate. Just leave him alone, for crying out loud. He can grow up illiterate all by himself. He doesn't need any help. One time I had a little problem with a lawyer. And I did a case, and I paid this lawyer $6,000 a year. It was his retainer, so. And I got to push the button on my telephone. I think he was the fourth button down. Bickle was his name. I pushed the fourth button down. It was Bickle. He'd get on the telephone. And I'd say, hey, Bickle, I got this problem over here. What do you think? And he'd tell me what to do next. See, well, that's pretty important, you know, to be a CEO of your own corporation, own the stock, and have 30 employees. And you got a lawyer over here. He advises you. So, well, one day we had to do a case in court. Well, that cost a little extra, so he charged me $5,000 to do this case in court. We went into court, did the case, and lost. I pay the guy $6,000 a year to keep me out of trouble. He fails. I get into trouble. I pay him $5,000 to get me out of trouble. He fails. That's two failures in a row. Okay. Well, you can't have 100% and everything. So I said, okay. We went on to the next one. Well, a little while later, we had another court case come up. And so we went into court and we did that case. Cost me another $5,000. we got all through with the case, and we lost that one, too. I said, well, you know, that's two cases out of two that we lost. That's two times out of two that you failed to keep me out of trouble. If the guy had done his job, we wouldn't be going to court and getting sued to start with, would we? Third time's a charm. Some time goes by. Somebody else sued me. We go to court. Bickle goes in third time, loses the third time. You know, I walked out there, and I said, hell, it cost me $18,000 for 3 years, did three cases in 3 years, cost me $15,000 to defend. Let's see, that's 13, 1, 2, that's $33,000 to lose three cases. I said, hell, I don't need a lawyer. I don't need to pay a guy $33,000 over 36 months to lose three cases. I can go into court and lose three cases all by myself free. And the same thing is true here with education. You don't have to spend $168,000 to turn out a bumbling imbecile, an illiterate, for crying out loud. Hell, you can do that all by yourself, free of charge. The weakening academic abilities of students has resulted in a 72% increase in the number of colleges and universities adding remedial courses to accommodate the lower skills levels of their new entrants. Such a lowering of the course content will produce weaker degree programs, which will result in weaker college graduates, many of whom will re-enter the educational arena as teachers. This process is, in fact, what is occurring. Since 1973, the SAT scores of prospective teachers have fallen 55 points, and the Department of Education reports half the newly qualified mathematics, science, and English teachers are not qualified to teach those subjects. Did you get that? Did you get that, kids? If you take a look at the mathematics, science, and English teachers in your public school, one half of them are not qualified to teach those topics, those subjects. But they're in there teaching them, and they're teaching them to your children. And so your children will come out with the same deficiencies that the teacher has, which in turn will require the educational institution that your child goes to lower its standards so that your kid can get in, so that your kid can get a teaching credential and go out and teach the next generation of children. Boys and girls, that's not survival of the fittest. Is it? In an effort to weed out the most incompetent teachers, 26 states have adopted teacher competency testing programs, and although 22 currently publish their results, many observers believe that the teacher incompetency problem isn't severe. What's happening in teacher testing prepared by the Department of Education presents a different picture. And in those states publicizing their competency testing results, 17% of the applicants failed. They failed. 17% of the applicants failed. Hell, these people have college degrees, for crying out loud. And they fail. All right, I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll be back with more on this thing called education next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.